Hey, listeners, welcome back to Massage Noir Murders. I'm your host, Renetta Rideout, and today I'll tell you a story that begins in May 2016 with the brutal murder of 19-year-old aspiring model Bridget Scheel. Bridget's story twists and turns and eventually intersects with four additional murders, including the murders of two children. The telling of the story will include descriptive detail of extreme violence, domestic violence, and sexual assault. I will, of course, be as respectful and discreet as possible as I discuss these topics, but needless to say, listener discretion is advised. Now, let's get into the story of Bridget Scheel. Just after sunrise on the morning of May 31st, 2016, a resident of a Southwest Atlanta neighborhood called 911 to report that he found a body in the Oakland City Park. The witness said he saw a pack of dogs gathered like they were about to eat something they saw on the ground. So naturally, the man went to see what was going on. But when he approached the dogs, he saw a nude, lifeless human body and hurried home to call the police. Immediately, officers, forensic personnel, and a team of detectives were dispatched to the scene. As detectives approached the body, they were struck by what they saw. Two detectives working the case told producers for 48 Hours Atlanta that the body looked like it had fallen from the sky or a helicopter. As they got closer, it became apparent that the body was that of a young woman. She had closely cut blonde hair and several distinctive tattoos. It was obvious she'd been shot multiple times in her back, all the way down to her legs. Now, one would imagine that the scene and the body would be covered with blood, but neither were. There were no drips, no pools of blood, no spray anywhere in the area. Detectives speculated that the victim had been killed elsewhere, and the coroner was in agreement with that. Those gathered at the scene couldn't believe the cold manner in which this young woman had been discarded. She had nothing on and nothing was around her. Her clothes were nowhere in sight. There was no purse, no wallet, no shoes. There was only her body splayed out in the open area near the basketball courts. With very little to go on, police closely examined the body, and one detective working the case, Detective Vincent Velasquez, noticed the victim had long blue acrylic nails and asked the coroner to collect them for evidence in case they contained evidence from the murderer. And because the woman had been found nude, a rape kit was also added to the checklist. As detectives looked upon Bridget's face, they noticed she was very young and she was wearing makeup and even had earrings on. It got them thinking that perhaps Bridget had gone out the night before. After all, it was Memorial Day weekend, so lots of parties were probably going on. However, at this point, it was way too early to speculate too much. Back at the station, detectives checked missing persons reports for anything matching the victim's description, and they ran her fingerprints through the database as well. Unfortunately, they learned right away that there weren't any missing persons reports matching the victim's description, and her fingerprints had no hits in Fulton County. Okay, so this is a little setback, but such is the nature of the beast in an investigation like this. So police pivot and decide to expand their search to include results from surrounding counties. And boom, they get a hit. Detectives match the ID of a 19-year-old Bridget Scheel in DeKalb County to their victim. Now that they know who their victim is, they have the difficult task of notifying her mother. Police head to the last known residence for Bridget to talk to her mom, Angela. When officers arrived at Angela's house and identified themselves, instinctively, she knew the news wasn't good. She had the dreadful feeling that something terrible happened to her daughter, and sadly, detectives confirmed her worst fear. Now, as you can imagine, the news about Bridget's death shocked Angela to her core. And so she basically had a meltdown. She started screaming and running through her house in obvious distress. As a mom myself, I can't imagine receiving news like that. There's no telling what I would do. So to me, her reaction was totally justified. Eventually, Angela calmed down enough for police to question her about the last time she saw or spoke to Bridget. Basically, they were looking for any information about Bridget at all. Angela told the police that Bridget was primarily raised by her grandparents, Jim and Beverly Toole, in Washington, D.C., and that her relationship with Bridget was pretty strained. There was a lot of friction between them, and they didn't really see eye to eye on things. Angela said the last conversation she had with Bridget was hostile and didn't end on good terms. Apparently, they had gotten into it about the early curfew Angela imposed. Of course, Bridget pushed back about that rule, and ultimately, it resulted in Bridget leaving her mom's house again. And although Bridget had nowhere else to go and would be living out of her car, Angela wasn't too concerned because this was something that had happened a number of times before. And with that heartbreaking conversation behind them, detectives follow up with Beverly, Bridget's grandmother. Beverly told detectives that she and Bridget were incredibly close and both described each other as one another's hearts. And this to me was just so sweet because I'm also super duper close to my grandmother. And I can just picture, you know, Bridget being very close with her grandmother. Beverly said she spoke with Bridget a few days before she was murdered and that she received a text from Bridget on the morning of Memorial Day to wish her a happy holiday and to tell her she loved her. Now, the I love you text kind of caused police to speculate again that maybe this text message was indicative that there was a problem in Bridget's life that she hadn't talked about with anyone. When police asked Beverly if Bridget told her where she'd been living, Beverly told them that she never asked. She avoided asking Bridget too many questions for fear that it would cause Bridget to cut her off like she did her mom, Angela. As the team continues to investigate, they gather tidbits of information to help them put together a picture of Bridget's life. They learn that she relocated to Atlanta to be closer to her mom and to pursue a career in the entertainment industry. Bridget had big hopes and dreams to elevate her life and caught a chance to even appear in a music video for a Ghanaian rapper named Chris Waddle for the song Biagia. I know that was probably like hard to understand. I had to practice saying it 1,000 times. And so I apologize to anyone who knows that song and thinks I butchered the name. Sorry about that. So the video was posted on YouTube May 9th, just 3 weeks before Bridget's murder. I watched the video and I have to say it's so eerie to see her laughing and smiling and dancing, having a great time. All the while I know that not long after the video was filmed, she would be gone. I couldn't help but feel sad and disgusted by the senseless loss of her young life. She truly was a lovely young woman, and she had such a pretty smile. Anyway, while the police tried to piece together details of Bridget's life, the medical examiner called with an update on preliminary findings. The ME confirmed what detectives suspected. Bridget had been raped and was shot 6 times in her back, buttocks, and legs. The shot that took her life entered the middle of her back and tore straight through her. Before police could ask about the type of bullets used to kill her, the medical examiner blew their minds when he told them what kind of bullets were used. Known as RIP bullets, short for radically invasive projectile bullets, the ammo was designed to kill. What makes these bullets unique is that unlike regular bullets that release gunpowder upon impact, RIPs explode fragments of shrapnel meant to cause maximum damage when they hit their target. Bridget was shot with 6 of these horrible things, and I can't even imagine the agony, shock, and fear she had to have felt when the first bullet struck her. The ME also told detectives that Bridget had been running when she was gunned down. So the poor girl was literally running for her life as some psychopath used her for target practice from a long distance. And once Bridget was down, her killer shot her again in the back to ensure she stayed down, delivering the fatal round. I have to be honest, the sheer brutality involved in this murder seemed like overkill to me. I'm no detective or investigative journalist, but the fact that she was killed with these horrible bullets while forced to run naked through the park seems personal, like the intent was to cause as much terror and pain as possible. Who in the world could have so much hate in their heart for this young woman who seemed to be loved by all who knew her? What was the motive? These were the two questions that undoubtedly hung in the air for detectives, and they were determined to find answers. So now that they know how Bridget was killed, detectives turned their focus to Bridget's car. They knew she'd been living out of it for a while and that it possibly held evidence related to the murder inside, so they were very eager to search it. There was just one problem. They had no idea where the car was. After using Bridget's driver's license to pull information about her car, they discovered Bridget owned a red Ford Fusion, more like a burgundy wine color, but in all the source material I found, everyone just pretty much refers to it as red. And with this information, detectives decided that they needed the public's help to find her car. So they held a press conference. Detectives informed local media that the body that had been discovered early that morning was that of Bridget Scheel, and that they were looking for her Ford Fusion. There was something about this murder that pulled at the heartstrings of the citizens in Atlanta, because Bridget's social media accounts blew up with posts of dismay, shock, and condolences for the young woman. And most importantly, tips flowed in left and right. Within 15 minutes, people started calling the police station, dumping any and every detail they thought might be relevant. Of course, everyone and their mama thought they saw Bridget because there were sightings of her all over Atlanta, from the Kroger supermarket down the street around 7 p.m. to the park swimming pool with a friend. You name it, folks claim they saw it. But there were some calls that turned out to be solid leads. The first lead came from a guy who used to live in the same apartment complex as Bridget. Apparently, he tried to date her, but Bridget had a boyfriend at the time, so she and the guy just remained friends. Supposedly, Bridget confided in him at some point that she was afraid of her boyfriend because he regularly hit her, and he even pulled a gun on her more than once. The witness went on to say that Bridget told him that her boyfriend, quote, bought some scary looking bullets, end quote. The witness finished his statement by telling police the boyfriend's name, a name that they had already heard before, Kevin Kinney. Suddenly, Kevin Kinney shot up to the top of the list of people police had to talk to. When police ran Kevin's name in their database, they found that he'd been previously arrested and was convicted of felony burglary and for providing false ID to the police of DeKalb County. Needless to say, they wasted no time talking to Kevin, and so they drove to his house for the conversation. When they pulled up, Kevin was sitting on the porch with a group of friends and his girlfriend, Brittany. While Kevin was cooperative and agreed to talk to police, he basically had that I don't fuck with you vibe. But of course, he allowed detectives to ask their questions. So Kevin told police he assumed they were there because he was the last known person who was in a relationship with Bridget. He went on to say that the last time he saw Bridget was a couple of days prior to her death, while she, ironically, was in her car at Kroger. According to Kevin, he and Bridget broke up and she left to meet up with a friend at the Exxon gas station in Kevin's neighborhood. Detectives asked if it was common for Bridget to meet up with people at the gas station, and Kevin responded that Bridget was sleeping in her car there, so it was pretty normal. He said Bridget was often homeless because she'd get kicked out of her mom's house regularly, and most recently, he was the last person to kick her out. Clearly, the relationship between Kevin and Bridget did not end on good terms. It was known in the rumor mill that Kevin was abusive to Bridget, but there was also a call to police placed by Bridget confirming the abuse. Not long before Bridget's murder, she called 911 and told the dispatcher that her boyfriend Kevin had beaten her and threatened to kill her if she called the police. When the police arrived at the residence, because Bridget bravely did call them, she ultimately declined to press charges against Kevin. So 2 days after that, the police were called to the residence again, this time because of a fight that broke out between Bridget and Kevin's son's mother, Brittany. Okay, so if you're like me, you're probably wondering where this girlfriend Brittany came from. Well, as it turns out, the wild card in this love triangle was actually Bridget, because Kevin brazenly moved her into his home with his girlfriend, Brittany, and their young son. Kevin told Chris Hansen for Crime Watch Daily that he straight up told Brittany that he wanted to be in a relationship with Bridget and she was coming to live with him. And if she had any problems about that, too bad. Well, that went over about as well as you can probably imagine. And super long dramatic story short, the two young women fought and ended up spending the night in jail together. And side note, if you're super interested, I do recommend going on YouTube and finding that video of Kevin with Chris Hansen, because I have so many mixed feelings about Kevin. I would love to talk to you guys about that. Maybe you can join the Facebook discussion group that I have, or you can engage with me on Instagram, because I want to know what you guys think about Kevin. I'm on the fence. On one hand, he sounds really believable and convincing. And then on the other hand, he seems less so, to put it lightly. So I'm super curious what everyone else thinks. But anyway, I digress. After the ladies spent the night in jail together, not long after that, Bridget decided to move out, obviously. And at this point, she had only been living there for about a month. But she opted to just sleep in her car at the gas station than to deal with more of that drama. And I totally cannot blame her. So before ending the conversation with Kevin, detectives asked him if he owned a gun. Naturally, being the very slippery dude he seems to be, Kevin answered the question with a question, saying, quote, "Why would I own a gun when I'm a felon, bruh?" End quote. I guess police accepted the non-answer, because the next thing they knew, Kevin blurted out how this whole situation was really messing with his head and going on about how much he liked Bridget. He had a similar reaction in the Chris Hansen interview, during which he cried and talked about how much he loved Bridget and that he would have married her. You can't see me, but I'm definitely rolling my eyes. His actions do not scream love to me, but hey, to each his own. While police side-eyed Kevin like I am, they got a sense that he was telling the truth. But first, they wanted to talk to Brittany before they considered ruling either of them out as suspects. When the conversation with Brittany began, detectives asked her what she knew about Bridget, and Brittany blurted out that what she knew about Bridget was her sleeping with her man. So I'm putting it nicely, because old girl definitely snatched some edges with what she actually said. The way she responded to the question led me to believe she still harbored animosity towards Bridget. However, according to Brittany, after the two fought and they were locked up together, they talked it out and ultimately came to the conclusion that Kevin was playing them both. So the two women decided to be cool with each other. I don't know about you, but there's a part of me that doesn't totally buy that, but, you know, anything's possible. Police end their interview with Brittany by asking her for an alibi on Monday night, the last night that Bridget was seen alive. She said she was with Kevin all day and that they were in bed together by midnight. Yes, this is a convenient alibi, but detectives, again, were inclined to believe them both. So they moved on. The next move detectives made was to check out that Exxon gas station Bridget was known to stay at. They spoke to a woman there who I don't know if she lived at the gas station as well, or if she was just there so often and knew Bridget, but the woman said she was good friends with Bridget. She went on to tell police that she was devastated that Bridget had been murdered so viciously and that Bridget was a good person who didn't deserve anything like that. Other than speaking on Bridget's character, however, the interview didn't yield any useful information for the investigation. So detectives went back to the station where they received a phone call that gave them their first solid lead and helped lay out a timeline of Bridget's last movements that night. Jasmine, a friend of Bridget's, phoned detectives and told them that she had let Bridget stay at her house for a few days. In fact, the two friends were supposed to attend a mansion party on Monday night together, but Bridget disappeared before they could go. According to Jasmine, the two had been getting dressed and having a good time. And ladies, I know you know how it is when you're getting all dolled up for a night out on the town with your girlies. It's all fun and games and picture taking. Bridget had been flooding her Snapchat with pictures of herself getting dressed and dancing around. By the time Bridget was ready to go, Jasmine still hadn't quite finished. Now, Jasmine is known for taking a long time to get dressed, so Bridget had some time on her hands. At this point, she decided to go wait in her car and told Jasmine to come out when she was ready. I don't know why Bridget decided to go outside instead of waiting in the house, but I imagine she was feeling a little impatient to get the party started and maybe wanted to motivate her friend to come out faster. But whatever the reason, Bridget went outside, and sadly, it would be the last time Jasmine saw her. When Jasmine was finally ready to go and came out to get in the car, both Bridget and her car were nowhere to be seen. Of course, Jasmine is like, okay, what gives? So at 10:53 p.m., she called Bridget on FaceTime to find out what was up. Bridget answered the call, but Jasmine could tell something was wrong because Bridget wasn't smiling. Jasmine described her face as just being plain, and she could tell Bridget's good mood was gone. Bridget told Jasmine that she went to the store real quick and she would be right back. She didn't offer any additional details or explanation and ended the call, which, by the way, only lasted 9 seconds. At this point, Jasmine felt some type of way about the brief conversation, so she sent Bridget a text message asking if she was okay. Bridget never responded. Jasmine went on to tell police that the two didn't have any plans to meet up with anyone at the party or at her place, so she had no idea who she might have been with or why she left. And as far as she knew, Bridget was alone. Detectives asked Jasmine if she had any idea what store Bridget might have gone to, and Jasmine said there was a gas station in her neighborhood, so she assumed that's where Bridget had gone, but again, she wasn't sure. By this time, it's late at night, and detectives have been working the case all day since the body was discovered that morning. Much to my surprise, a happy surprise, I might add, the police gathered all this information in just one day of investigating. I think that's pretty impressive, especially considering that the victims featured in episodes 1-5 didn't receive this level of dedication from law enforcement at all. It just goes to show how much can be done in a short period of time when people do their jobs. The detectives assigned to this case were committed to solving it in a way I haven't seen in other cases of Black victims. No one had to beg and plead for them to do their duty. They simply did it, and their hard work was paying off. Although police have come far in a day's work, they knew they were still missing a major piece of the puzzle, Bridget's car. The next morning, on Wednesday, June 1st, local CBS and Fox News channels reported that Bridget's car had been located behind a strip mall between the wall of the shopping center and a fence. Detectives confirmed the car was Bridget's and collected all evidence in the immediate area. They ended up finding Bridget's purse, from which it was evident that someone had gone straight for the money pocket. They also found a can of Coke and some blunt wrappers on the ground close to the car. Now, it's a safe assumption that the discovery of the vehicle was like a treasure trove of new possibilities, but the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, or GBI, took Bridget's car back to the GBI facilities to be processed there. I have no idea why or if this is just standard operating procedure, but for whatever reason, the car went with them. While waiting for GBI to do whatever they were going to do, a couple of the detectives on the team went back to the strip mall where the car had been found. There was something nagging them about the location. The car's location and Jasmine's apartment were in close proximity to each other, but where Bridget's body had been found was a whole 25 minutes away. Detectives Quinn and Velasquez felt like something might have been missed where the car was, so they went back to check, you know, to do their due diligence. And sure enough, their instincts were right on the money. Not far from where the car was, detectives noticed something that looked like clothing. It was striped black and white and was tossed on the other side of the fence. They also saw there was a cigarette carton on top of the garment of clothing, along with an empty Sprite bottle. Police collected the cigarette box, the garment that they realized was actually a dress, and the Sprite bottle. Now, for whatever reason, the detective that collected the evidence grabbed the bottle with his bare hands. I cannot even tell you how hard I cringed when I saw that. And this was documented on that 48-hour show I mentioned earlier. So it was literally on recording. Why risk contaminating the evidence? And this particular detective has 16 years of experience, and no shade, because I think he's awesome. And I really respect how he has handled this case. Some of his press conferences have been really getting the media gathered on some of these rumors that they spread about Bridget, which I will not be reporting here. So much respect to the detective, but sir, can you please keep some gloves in your pocket for this very reason? Anyway, for whatever reason, it happened. And the police ended up bagging the cigarette carton and the Sprite bottle, but they kept the dress out. The detective continued to bag the evidence, and Detective Quinn called Angela, Bridget's mom, after sending her a picture of the dress they found. Angela confirmed it was Bridget's dress and added that she loved that style so much so that she had several colors of the same type of dress. And side note again, I can totally relate to that because when I find something that I like a lot, if they have it in more than one color, I usually buy it. I can totally relate. So this was basically the validation detectives needed to feel like they were on the right track. But they decided to make one more call, this time to Jasmine, the last friend to see Bridget. And they wanted to confirm if that was a dress she'd been wearing that night. Unfortunately, Jasmine was not able to confirm that Bridget was wearing that particular dress when she last saw her. Instead, she told Detective Quinn that she'd been wearing a black spaghetti strap bodysuit with blue jean shorts and tan strappy high-heeled sandals. So now detectives wonder why Bridget's dress was found so far from where her body was, and where were the clothes she'd been wearing when she went missing? Again, while they found new evidence, they also had new questions. Not long after Detectives Quinn and Velasquez searched the area the car was found at, the team found out that someone sent them a picture that Bridget had posted to Snapchat at 10:27 p.m. The picture was of Bridget's legs as she was walking through the grass. The caption read, quote, "Too pretty to be walking through grass," end quote. This was the last social media post by Bridget, and it was nearly 30 minutes before her FaceTime with Jasmine. So whoever took Bridget took her between 10:27 and 10:53. What's more, not long after the Snapchat picture was sent, detectives found out there was a call placed to 911 at 1:06 a.m., reporting multiple gunshots at the Oakland City Park. As they read the report, they noticed the caller actually left their phone number. So detectives wasted no time again and called the witness to hear her story firsthand. The witness told them that she heard 6 gunshots coming from the park very early Tuesday morning. She also said she heard a scream that sounded like, quote, a young lady, end quote. This witness's statement adds depth and clarity to their current theory. Up until this point, they had been assuming that Bridget was killed elsewhere because of the lack of blood at the scene. But this statement pretty much puts that to bed. They still can't explain why there wasn't much blood and no bullets or shell casings anywhere, but it's pretty clear now that Bridget had been running through the park when she was killed. So in their minds, there must be evidence of a shooting in the park. With that in mind, they went back to Oakland City Park, where Bridget had been found, to look around again. This time, they brought the canines and everyone searched the area. But again, they came up empty-handed. That is, until one detective looked up and right above his head was a surveillance camera discreetly mounted on a streetlight. The discovery of the camera excited the team, and they were hopeful the recording would show what happened that night. When they reviewed the footage, they saw a car speed into the empty parking lot around midnight, bust a U-turn, and then leave again. As soon as they saw the car enter the frame, they immediately thought it looked like Bridget's car, but it was dark and hard to be certain. The picture quality was fuzzy, so they couldn't really make out the plate number. However, they believed this was Bridget's car and theorized that perhaps the killer had been trying to block off Bridget's escape. It's now the fourth day of the investigation, Friday, June 3rd, and detectives couldn't wait anymore to get a look at the contents of Bridget's car, so they go to the GBI facility to do so. Right away, they get a much clearer picture of who Bridget was as a person and what she was going through. She was a young woman trying to find her way in this complicated world. As mentioned before, she'd been living in her car, so it was full of all the things anyone would need when they're living in the car. Detectives found bags of clothes in her trunk, clothes in her car, shoes, makeup, accessories, hygiene necessities, her resume. And this particular detail actually brought tears to my eyes for some reason. There was something about seeing her work history and knowing that she had aspirations for more and seeing all of this in black and white, in her own words, it really just hit me in the gut. As police take in the sad sight of the car, they look on the floor of the front seat and lo and behold, guess what they find? The outfit Bridget had been wearing when she was with Jasmine, the black bodysuit, blue jean shorts, panties, and her high-heeled shoes. It was clear Bridget had taken off her clothes right there in her car, which answered the question of where she changed clothes that night. Unfortunately, detectives still didn't find any evidence of the gun, no ammo, nor any shell casings. In other words, they hit a wall. Just as detectives were planning their next move, they get a call from a witness who said she saw Bridget on Memorial Drive at the Shell gas station just before 11:31 p.m., and she was not alone. Y'all, this witness was like a dream to the police because not only had she seen Bridget wearing the clothes she had on at Jasmine's house, she also saw who was with her. The witness said Bridget was in a burgundy-colored car with two black males. One guy was driving the car, the second guy was sitting in the right back passenger seat, and Bridget was in the front seat. And according to the witness, Bridget did not look happy. So in my mind, I imagine that the dude behind Bridget probably held a gun to the back of her seat and maybe threatened to shoot her if she tried to do anything. I don't know, of course, but this is what comes to my mind. The woman on the phone also told detectives that the driver was dark-skinned, had short black hair, wore a goatee, and had on a white t-shirt. Apparently, this man was yelling at Bridget, and she looked terrified and anxious. At some point, the witness said Bridget and her captors were seen talking to a homeless woman at the gas station. Now, the investigation, which had started to slow down, had new life breathed into it with this witness's account. Detectives had a new lead and a witness who put Bridget and her captors in a completely different part of town than they previously searched. So as you can imagine, police raced to the Shell gas station on Memorial Drive in hopes of gaining surveillance footage and possibly speaking to the homeless person the witness saw that night. When police arrive at the gas station, they spotted two cameras, one facing the gas station pumps that would have a perfect view of Bridget's car, and one behind the cash register. Now, I'm sure you know how wishy-washy the camera situation can be. So many places have cameras just for show, and they aren't really recording anything. And even more times when they do record, the footage is recorded over or deleted. But like so many other times in this case, investigators got lucky again. Unfortunately, the camera facing the pumps wasn't functional. However, the inside camera worked perfectly, and police were about to see what happened inside that store. On the recording, detectives could see the front door, and you know how the doors at the gas station are mostly glass? Well, through the glass, a red, burgundy-ish colored car can be seen pulling up right next to the door. Thanks to the busted camera outside, they couldn't see who was in the car, but there's a very clear view of the plate and the hood of the car. Then a woman who appears to be homeless enters the store and she purchases two blunt wrappers and a can of Coke, and she leaves. A few seconds later, she's seen coming back into the store, and this time she buys a bottle of Sprite before leaving again. After this last purchase, the car is seen driving off. As close as detectives feel they are to catching whoever these two guys were, sadly, the case begins to slow down pretty fast after the gas station tip. It's hard to believe they've gotten so far in such a short period of time, but without additional witnesses or some other lead, police aren't really sure which way to go next. So almost a month after Bridget's murder, on June 20th, police and Atlanta City Councilwoman Cleta Winslow hold a press conference during which the councilwoman announces that she would personally put up a $5,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in Bridget's case. In addition, the Atlanta Police Fund also pledged to match the $5,000, bringing the total reward up to $10,000. Authorities were confident that the money would help bring closure to this case. However, they would soon learn that would never happen, and more than a year would pass before a big break in the case would come. And I hate to do this to you, my darling listeners, but you'll have to tune in next time for the explosive finale to this tragic tale. In closing, I want to give a shout out to everyone in Bridget's life who helped her along the way. From my understanding, she was a sweet young woman and people loved her, and those who did supported her however they could. Thank you for being there for her. And to all of you who have found yourselves in a position to help a friend, whether that be giving them a ride to an interview or letting them crash on your couch a few days, or even buying them a meal or some coffee. Keep being a good person. This world is cold, and we need that type of love and warmth. Thank you for being a bright spot to those facing hardship and darkness. This episode was written, produced, and edited by Renetta Rideout.